Welcome to the Global Research News Hour Summer Series. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs broadcast produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation, in partnership with the Centre for Research on Globalization. Our shows air on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States and are podcast at the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we are airing a speech by Paul Hellyer on the topic of the Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, or CETA. The talk took place on October 20th, 2016 at the University of Winnipeg's Eckhart Gramite Hall Auditorium. The presentation was part of a multi-city Canadian speaking tour supported by the Canadian Bank Reformers, an organization dedicated to monetary and banking reform in Canada and around the world. Paul Theodore Hellyer is an engineer and a political commentator. He is the longest-serving member of Canada's Privy Council, having served in Canada's House of Commons as far back as 1949 under Prime Minister Louis Saint-Laurent. Hellyer has served as Minister of National Defence and as acting Prime Minister. He founded the Canadian Action Party in 1997 to provide Canadians with an economic nationalist option in the face of free trade and other legislation threatening the sovereignty of Canada. He has written multiple books addressing the theme of money and threats to Canadian democracy. These include Funny Money, A Common Sense Alternative to Mainline Economics from 1994, Goodbye Canada from 2001, Light at the End of the Tunnel, A Survival Plan for the Human Species in 2010, and The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis. The speaking tour coincided with talks between the Government of Canada and the European Union negotiators being conducted in Brussels, intended to finalize the negotiations and set the stage for all parties to finally sign the CETA. Hellyer argues that provisions within the agreement would eliminate tools that have been at Canada's disposal as far back as 1939 in order to build the country's infrastructure, transition to an energy future free from fossil fuels, and invest in education, healthcare, and other vital social programs. The thrust of his argument is that Canada's publicly owned central bank would be blocked from providing low-interest loans for government initiatives by private foreign banks utilizing instruments within the CETA. His speaking tour was a call to arms for what he calls a tsunami of change in which the Canadian people can and must assert control over their own lives. So here is Paul Hellyer speaking at the University of Winnipeg on October 20th, 2016 on stopping CETA and adopting a new social contract.
The subject of my address is a plan to make Canada really prosperous again, but might just as easily have been an orange alert or a red alert now, re-CETA, the Canada-Europe Trade Agreement, which Prime Minister Trudeau hopes to sign next week. In which case, if it were ratified, it would be game over for Canada. And any hope of really being prosperous again would go out the window. So that's where we are tonight, and we're right on the cusp. In fact, it could be either one or both titles because they are primarily about money. What it is and its power. And why there never seems to be enough of it to provide jobs for the unemployed and to meet the many legitimate needs of government at all levels to build new infrastructure as well as maintaining and renewing that which already exists. Well, it's impossible to understand the magnitude and importance of the subject without putting it in context of the real world. How did we get into this mess? And who is responsible? Who is calling the shots? As early as October 1940, the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. wrote a memo assuming that Hitler would lose the war and saying that they should start working on a new empire, which would take in all of the land that presumably Hitler had his eyes on, plus all of North America, plus many Southeast Asian countries as well. And the truth is, they've been working at it ever since. When the war ended, there was an operation called Operation Paperclip. I don't know how many of you have heard of it. Well, you're a very informed audience. And as you know, the U.S. military was interested in getting its hands on a number of scientists, Nazi scientists, before they were taken over by somebody else, by the Russians or the Chinese or whoever. And so they got their hands on a list that they wanted, and they went after them. They got President Truman to give them the okay, but on the basis that there were no members of that group that had close Nazi associations. Unfortunately, the military, we understand very well from personal experience, ignored the president's order and just took anybody they wanted, and it included a number of people who had been very active in the Nazi Party. And they were given new identities and brought into the United States and given new jobs with new CVs, and some in the military and some in intelligence and some in civil life. And one of the interesting dichotomies was that here was the CIA, good old CIA, meddling. They had one arm that was out looking for Nazis who had managed to get into the country illegally. And on the other hand, they were bringing them in under their own auspices and setting up identities for them so that they could have all the privileges and perks of American citizens. Well, presumably this was to help fight communists, but that was the beginning of what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex that he warned us to beware of. It is now an integral part of the power elite, the one-tenth of the top 1% that I and many others have called the cabal. It comprises, first of all, the Council on Foreign Relations that began the Big Empire Project in the 1940s. Then the very secretive group called the Bilderbergers, which was organized post-war and with some good ideas, but eventually it became not only one of the most secretive, but one of the most powerful organizations in the whole world. And later, the less secretive Trilateral Commission joined the group after Zbigniew Brzezinski got the idea of Japan was coming up, thought they should be included. So he and David Rockefeller took the idea to the Bilderberg meeting, and it was approved, and so the Trilateral Commission was born. And you have three organizations with a lot of cross-membership, and I call them, in my books, the Three Sisters. You could also call them the Power Elite, a.k.a. the Cabal. And the cabal comprises not only the Three Sisters, but also the banking cartel, which is at its apex. It's the very top of the power structure. And then below that is the oil cartel. And just below that are the big transnational corporations, most of which are controlled directly or indirectly by the banking cartel. And then there are certain parts of intelligence organizations, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, our big brother who's keeping track of us all, so we don't need to worry. They know where we are. And other organizations, including the British MI6 and the Israeli Mossad. And huge, critically important slice of the U.S. military. And not only are they called the cabal, they are called in the United States the shadow government. And they have been running the United States since Eisenhower and running much of the Western world and more. This shadow government is so all-inclusive. So what the cabal is all-inclusive is in support of a new world order comprising a dictatorship controlled by them. The apex of their power is the money mafia, which has been robbing ordinary folks for centuries. The money mafia or cartel has a monopoly on the creation of money. Consequently, as money is the gasoline that drives economic engines, the cartel controls the levels of unemployment and rates of growth in most countries in the world, including, I'm sorry to say, our own. And there is no hope for the kind of robust growth that we had in the early post-war years as long as they have a monopoly. No hope. Because we're in a position where any government, it doesn't matter what stripe it is, needs money to do essential things, and there's only two ways to get it. That's taxation or borrowing. And some of us think taxes are just about high enough already. And secondly, we've got a huge national debt, federal, $615 billion, and that's just federal. It doesn't include the provinces and the municipalities. And there are a lot of people who think that we don't want to go further in debt because there's no way to pay it off. As long as the cartel has a monopoly, they create all the money as debt. And it's debt that has to be repaid, principal and interest, but nobody creates any money with which to pay either the principal or interest. So there's only one way to keep going, and that's to borrow more and keep going deeper and deeper into debt. So there's no hope for the kind of robust growth that we saw in the early post-war years, and that I was so familiar with my earlier years, than a huge infusion of government-created debt-free money. And it's going to take a lot of it, because the debt levels in the world today are the highest they have ever been. There's more debt than there's ever been before. And so we're drowning in an ocean of debt, and we have to dilute it enough to be able to keep going, and especially to have robust growth and positive economies. Well, to understand what I'm talking about, a little history of what money is and where it comes from can help. I had lunch with Mark Olson today, and we tried out on one of the waitresses, find out what she knew about money. And she knew a little more about it than some people, but not very much. And she knew that it was printed, but of course what she didn't know is that most of it isn't printed. And of our money supply today, I'm sure this audience would be pretty well aware of this. Only 3%, roughly, is legal tender. Less than 1% of coins, less than 3% of paper, printed money that you always see in the newsreels. The other 97% are bank accounts, bank entries. And they're not real money. They're not legal tender. They're just computer entries. That's all they are. But let's go back about three centuries. In 1640, Charles I confiscated all of the money in the mint at the Tower of London, stole from his people, Mr. Nice Guy, we call him. And so the rich people in London had to look somewhere else for safe places for their money. So they settled on the goldsmiths of Lombard Street. The goldsmiths of Lombard Street were chosen because they had the boxes already that were fireproof and could be used, and so they took deposits of the rich people's money in London, and they gave certificates, receipts really, for the money that was deposited, and paid interest on the receipts, on the understanding they could lend the money to their rich friends when it wasn't being used, which they did. But it didn't take them long to find out that they could lend more money than they had gold in their boxes, because people didn't come in and get it very often. Same thing as we do with cash today. Somebody would buy a fur coat, they wouldn't come in and get a bundle of gold and carry it over their back. They would just take certificates. A lot easier. And so what the goldsmiths did was a scam, and it was illegal, but they got away with it because it was legitimized when the Bank of England was chartered in July 27, 1694. The rich people of, first of all, King William had been waging war in France, and he'd run out of money. His armaments were shambles. He had to renew the armaments and build a new navy, and his credit was no good, so he couldn't borrow money. Somebody said, well, why don't you set up a bank, which he did, got Parliament to approve it. The rich people in London subscribed 1,200,000 pounds in gold and silver and lent all of it to the king at 8%, which is a pretty high interest rate for a government guaranteed loan. Then the king said, well, I'm very pleased with you, so I'm going to let you print P-R-I-N-T, an equal number of bills, certificates, saying Bank of Canada, and lend them to your rich friends at high interest rates. So in effect, the bank was able to lend the same money to two different people at the same time, the king and their friends, and collect interest on it twice. Well, that's better than getting interest on once. And that was really the beginning of what was called the partial reserve system of banking, which has been a plague ever since. Well, over the years, the greed of the avarice of the banks and the collusion of the politicians, that ratio, which was 2-to-1, what we call leverage, became much more generous. In the early years of the 20th century in the United States, federally incorporated banks had to have cash reserves, well, actually gold reserves, 25%. They'd have 25% gold against their depositors. In Canada, which I well remember, our banks had to have 8% cash. And that meant they could lend the same money 12 and a half times. Well, then along comes Dr. Friedman and his friends at the University of Chicago, and they put in a plug for monetarism and deregulation, and that resulted in the banks being able to lend the same money 20 times. Some of them a lot more than that, but 20 times is sort of the norm. And in my opinion, that's grand larceny. You know, for a long while I've kept a file on the mafia, or mafia, if you prefer. And you'll recall that there was an investigation in Montreal not too long ago where it was alleged that the mafia had been, Sicilian mafia had been taking 2.5% off the top of all of the construction contracts in the city for years. The money mafia takes 95% off the top. So I guess if 2.5% is a good thing, 95% is better. They can invest $5 million in what I call blood, sweat, and tears money. That's the kind of money you go out and earn. Working, cutting down trees, giving haircuts, working in a shop, working in a factory. Blood, sweat, and tears, because you've earned the money. But they only have to put up $5 million of that to make loans equal to $100 million. And the $100 million has to be repaid in blood, sweat, and tears money plus interest. And I don't think it's fair, for example, this wasn't a problem in my day, but it has been recently, that they can loan students $50,000 to finish their studies, and all of the blood, sweat, and tears money that they invest to do that is $2,500. But the students have to repay $50,000 in blood, sweat, and tears plus interest. And that's the way the system works. Well, the way the banks create money is this way. If you need $35,000 for a car, you go in, see your bank manager, and ask for a loan. And they'll say, well, what collateral have you got? Any stocks or bonds? If you haven't got that, second mortgage on your cottage, or third mortgage on your house. And if you haven't got that, maybe a rich friend or relative that will co-sign. And when they're satisfied with the collateral, they'll ask you to sign a note for the $35,000 principal, repayable on demand, plus interest at some prime plus some rate. It used to be quite higher than it is now. But let's say 3 or 4% or 5%, depending on the color of your eyes. And the way they make their money is by what they call a spread. If you decide, left something out here. Once you have signed the note, Then they go over and tap their computers, and presto, $35,000 appears in your account, which you can go out and spend to buy a car. Seconds earlier, that money did not exist. And it's the biggest myth in banking that when you go in to borrow money, you're borrowing the money that I or somebody else deposited the day before. Not so. They are nearly always fully lent. And when you go in to borrow money and they give you a loan, they manufacture it out of thin air. But then you have to repay it with blood, sweat, and tears. And the way they, as they say, the way they make their money is because if you decided not to buy the car right away because you thought you were going to get a better one, the new model's coming out, and you leave the money there for a while, they'll pay either zero interest or maybe an eighth of 1% while they're charging 3, 4, or 5 on your note. And the difference between these two is the way they make their money. So the more loans they create, the more mortgages they create, the more money they make. And the present system is insane. And you don't need a PhD in economics to understand this. Anybody with grade 8 or 10 or 12 mathematics should know that the system is unstable and unsustainable. I wasn't just kidding when I said the rich elite have been robbing the rest of us for centuries. Sometime this year, 1% of the world's population will own as much as the world's wealth as all the other 99%. Can you imagine? Two years ago, 88 families owned 50% of the world's wealth. Last year was 80 families. This year it is 62 families. And it's getting smaller and more concentrated all the time. And I can't really get my mind around this. Because I stopped to think about it, and what we're really saying is that you start taking all the big cities of the world, Peking, Beijing, Tokyo, San Francisco, Vancouver, Winnipeg, Toronto, Montreal, New York, across the pond, London, Manchester, Paris, Bonn, on and on around the whole world. And every second one of those cities, they own lock, stock, and barrel. I don't know, it's almost beyond my comprehension, and yet that is a statistic. And it's getting worse every year.
My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Today, as part of our summer series, we're airing a talk by the Honorable Paul Hellyer on the need to stop the Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement and adopt a new social contract for Canada involving monetary reform and use of the Bank of Canada. This talk was presented at the University of Winnipeg on October 20th, 2016. Here, once again, is the Honorable Paul Hellyer.
And this concentration of wealth is due to globalization. Trade treaties, the transfer of power from the people to the elite, and a private monopoly on money creation. And these two things are leading to disaster. World debt is at an all-time high and getting higher all the time. While a study for the Davos, or Davos if you prefer, forum, estimated that world unemployment could soar to Listen to this. 250 million people this year. But it doesn't need to be that way. And that's the good news. The banks don't own the right to create money. We the people do. Banks are just licensees, subject to rules set by politicians. And it's the rules that are really faulty. It's a boom-bust system that allowed Wall Street and the City of London to precipitate the crash of 1929, leading to the Great Depression of the 1930s. It was the rules that allowed Wall Street to crash the system again in 2007, 2008, and create the Great Recession that has affected millions of people worldwide and is responsible largely for the fact that we have 1 million young Canadians unemployed on average ever since that time. And it's a longer time now than the Great Depression. And it's going on and on. It will last as long as the present rules and the banks rule the world. In a new book entitled The Great Divide, Unequal Societies and What We Can Do About Them, Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz says that the only hope to save capitalism for the 99% of the people is a change in the balance of power. Warren Buffett, one of the world's richest men, recently said there is a war between the rich and the poor, and we, the rich, are winning, as if we didn't know. Well, that is the key. The Stiglitz proposals are less than convincing, but the principle is dead on. The private monopoly on money creation has to end, period. And the money creation function has to be shared by the people and the banks so that trillions of dollars can be created for governments debt-free to dilute that ocean of debt in which I pointed out we are drowning, while at the same time providing the aggregate demand, which is another term for purchasing power, to resuscitate the world economy and provide hope to the tens of millions of unemployed youth who have lost hope. Well, theoretically, it should be the United States that does something about this mess because they're primarily responsible for it. In my opinion, we should take the initiative to set it right. Unfortunately, the chances of that happening are nil. Absolutely nil. A little over 100 years ago, the U.S. Congress handed over the right to create money to a handful of the richest bankers in the world when the Federal Reserve System was adopted. In my book, The Money Mafia, I call it the biggest heist in history. Just 3 years after the passage of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, President Woodrow Wilson realized the magnitude of the mistake and wrote, and I quote, "A great industrial nation is controlled by a system of credit," and then added, "We have become one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world." Can you imagine politicians being irresponsible enough to hand over the people's right to create money to the world's richest bankers? Won't answer that question. But the bill was not repealed. Is still in operation. After more than 100 years, the sellout is still the law. nor is it likely to be repealed as long as it is legal for financial institutions to contribute to political election expenses. The best that the U.S. can hope for is that someone else will take the lead and show the way. One success would create the political climate for action elsewhere. And here comes the rub. Of all the countries in the G20, Canada is in the best position to act. We have all of the essentials necessary to do it and to do it quickly. We own our central bank, the Bank of Canada, outright, 100%. The Minister of Finance has the ultimate control over policy. This was hashed out when they had what they called the coin controversy. And finally, a deal was struck that the bank would have day-to-day independence, but the Minister of Finance would have the ultimate control, and all he had to do was put his policy in a letter and send it to the governor, but then he had to publish it in the Canada Gazette so the people would know what was going on, and then they could judge who was right and who was wrong. And then we have a precedent that proved the principle of shared responsibility for money creation. The only thing missing at the present time is the political will to innovate, even when the need is so obvious. And this distresses me because I have seen the system work. There are both advantages and disadvantages to being old. In 1938, there were no jobs in Canada. None. In 1939, the war broke out, and soon everyone was working in the Army, Navy, or Air Force, building factories, making munitions, doing something useful towards the war effort. We actually reached a record low of 1% unemployment. And I'm not recommending that now because to reach that would be inflationary, but I think we could reduce what we've got by half and put half of the young people back to work, and that would provide opportunity and hope for everyone. Then, after the war, you might say, "Well, where did the government get the money to do that?" Well, the Bank of Canada printed it, P-R-I-N-T-E-D, printed it, and turned it over to the government at near zero cost. If anybody's interested in the mechanism, I could tell them how it actually worked. After the war, we kept the same system where the Bank of Canada was providing the Government of Canada with very large sums of near zero cost money, and we used it for all of the major infrastructure. St. Lawrence Seaway, Trans-Canada Highway, the Dew Line. Anybody remember what the Dew Line was? The distant early warning line of the radar stations all around the periphery of the continent. Very expensive. And lots of projects, including probably the Gardiner in Toronto, which is long overdue to come down, and also to help finance our Social Security system. And we paid for all of that, including the infrastructure, without borrowing any significant amount of money, and without an inflation rate that was any different than the average in the OECD countries. So we've done it, it works, we have a precedent, and we should never have abandoned it. The system worked like a charm from 1939 to 1974, gave us the best years of the 20th century. Then in 1974, the Bank of Canada Governor Gerald Bowie adopted monetarism. I doubt very much that he knew what he was doing. And it's been downhill ever since. And incidentally, in 1974, we seldom saw anyone sleeping on the streets. There were no food banks in Canada, not one. Now there are 2,065. And the Bank of Canada abandoned its shareholders, us, in favor of taking orders from the Bank for International Settlements in Zurich, Switzerland, with its Nazi roots. And they were required to stop lending cheap money to government. Well, they used interest rates to control inflation in accordance with the other central banks, and we had those two terrible recessions. And I remember how awful they were. Thousands of people put out of their jobs. Thousands of people lost their homes. A lot of people lost their farms and their businesses. And we had to borrow expensive money. Some of you will remember in 1981, 82, interest rates went up as high as 22% in Canada. And if you want to hear of something really ridiculous, I was in the building business for a while in my youth, and I sold a lot of houses for about $15,000 each. And they had been resold, and during 81, 82, there were people who actually paid more interest on their mortgages in 1 year than the original price of the house. So talk about inflation. There you had a case for it right there with the present system, not the other system. So they brought on two of these disastrous recessions, 81, 82, and again in 1991. And then they put the country in debt because we would run deficits, it would be rolled over into debt, and it just kept compounding. And how much interest do you think we have paid on the debt during that period? 90 cents? When a friend gave me a figure, I didn't believe her, so I got the parliamentary library, to which I still have access as a privy councillor, to do the research for me. And from fiscal year 74-75 to 2013-14, we, the people of Canada, paid $1.17 trillion in interest. $1.17 trillion. Mark and I were talking at noon about how you can envisage a trillion. And that was the money that should have been used for health care and education and the arts and for looking after our Aboriginal brothers and sisters more properly and decently, and for fixing the infrastructure that was falling apart. And all of that money went into interest instead of the places where it should have gone. So we have been underspending on the real problems for 45 years. And that's the reason we have a deficit in so many areas, and so many things have been left undone. The U.S. equivalent would have been 12 to 13 times that. The bulk of the U.S. federal debt. So it should be obvious what we have to do. Banks have to return to the cash reserve system, and a group of us, actually about 40, came up with a very sensible, workable system 2 or 3 years ago, presented to the government of the day, which had no interest, and presented again to the government of the present time, which has so far shown no interest, would allow the Bank of Canada to create $150 billion a year and deposited in the accounts of the federal government on the understanding that it would be split 50-50 between the federal government and the provinces and territories on a per capita basis. And this would not be done for just 1 year, but 7 years. Manitoba's share, based on the figures, would have been $2.724 billion a year for 7 years, which would have helped a lot, I'm sure, to do some of the things that needed to be done. And this would go on for 7 years, and the banks would have to return to the cash reserve system at a rate of about 5% a year for those 7 years, until they had a cash reserve of 34%. And people were always saying the myth that if the government creates money, it's inflationary. Well, if you let the banks spend it two or three times, it would be. But this was sterilized by increasing the bank's cash reserves from zero, which there are today. Most people don't know that. In 1991, the government of the day eliminated cash reserves altogether, so our banks have no cash except just enough to give you for weekend spending. And you're lucky if your bank has a cent or a cent and a half of real legal tender for every dollar you think you have in the bank. It would bring them up to the level of 34%, which would eliminate inflation during that entire period. It would give the banks the kind of reserve which would mean they would no longer be subject to the ups and downs that they've been, and it would make the system stable. And most important of all, I think, after the end of the 7 years, money created each year would be on the basis of 34% for the government. And we figured that that would be enough that all governments, federal, provincial, and municipal, could balance their budgets with lower taxes than we have now. And during the 7 years, they would have enough surplus to reduce their debt a little bit at the federal level, probably by about 30 or 33%. But it would be a system that would be permanent. Most important of all, the balance of power in the world would be permanently altered. The banks would no longer rule the world. And the people would be given back some responsibility for their own affairs. In other words, democracy would mean something, rather than today when it's just a hollow word. It would provide the kind of money necessary to do other things that need to be done. Number one problem in the world today is global warming. Number two is the monetary. But number two, the monetary is the most urgent, because if governments don't have any money, they're not going to be able to finance the fast turnover from fossil fuels to clean energy that is absolutely essential for the preservation of the planet. Absolutely. And I had two books on sale up there earlier, as you know, most of you saw. And in the first one, which was written about 3 years before the other one, I said we had 10 years to do this. In the latest one, The Money Mafia, I said we have 7 years. 7 years to replace the power source in every car, truck, tractor, plane, ship, and home in the world. Now, you've got to have a lot of money to do that. But it would certainly create a lot of jobs, too, like millions and millions of them. And people say, well, yeah, that couldn't be done. Don't you believe it? Again, a little experience helps. When World War II came along, we converted every car manufacturer and washing machine manufacturer and refrigerator manufacturer in the whole country, although they both in Canada and the United States, to the manufacture of munitions. Because we had a war to win. Now we've got an even more important war to win. We've got to do something. And right now, my main concern, I guess, is CETA. And you should know the reason, I'm sure you know. This agreement with Europe is part of a series which have all but, they are not trade agreements. They were labeled trade agreements to fool the public. They're investment and power agreements. And they're to give power from, take power away from the people and give it to foreign banks and corporations. And in a letter to the Prime Minister recently, I mentioned that Quebec had put a moratorium on fracking, for example, which some of us think shouldn't be a temporary moratorium, but a permanent one. And an American company sued for $250 million. And that's what they're allowed to do. If we ratify CETA, then all of this money that I was telling you about, which adds up, if your mathematics is good, to a little over $1 trillion in 7 years. In other words, getting back just about approximately as much as we paid out in interest to start catch up in all these areas. We couldn't do it because CETA would come into effect and foreign banks could sue us for tens or hundreds of millions of dollars for losses and potential losses of profits. So our goose would be cooked, and not just for a day, but forever. So naturally, maybe you have more up-to-date news than I have, but I'm just hoping that the people of Belgium who voted against it and are holding out will continue to hold out and won't get taken up by the power of the pressure that's being exerted on them, including by us. We sent Mr. Pettigrew, a former cabinet minister, over there to lobby with them and to try and persuade them to go along and be good fellows and let the treaty be signed next week. Well, the bottom line in my latest book is that the missing link in all of this is spirituality. Actually, in my two latest books, my second latest book, I have a chapter entitled Mammon Rules the World, and that is true, especially as long as we are captives of a corrupt financial system. But I try not to end a book on a totally down note. I give out the facts. And as you see, those of you who have bought the books, I always put in recommendations as to what has to be done, a whole list of them. I've never written a book yet that said the world's going to hell and I don't know what to do about it, because I don't think that's fair. Everybody can see that things are in bad shape. What they want to know is what they have to do about it. So that's the message we try to get through. And I point out that there are some wonderful things happening at the micro level. And I know a lot of people who've dedicated their lives to helping others starting orphanages and starting new hospitals and starting all sorts of things to share and to help people who are less off, well off than themselves. And that is going on by the thousand around the world. And we don't have to have a majority, but we have to have a bigger minority. And so what I'm calling for is a tsunami of change. And it starts with every one of us as an individual. Because we can't run the world, but we can run our own lives. That's the thing that we do have control over. And think of the needs of others. And live the golden rule, because I can't think of a problem anywhere in the world that couldn't be solved if we actually lived the golden rule. And that's the one precept that every major religion has in common, the golden rule. There's only one problem, that's none of us practice it. And if we did, a miracle would happen. Joy and justice would be intertwined in our journeys and in the world we create, because we're writing our own history. Then, and then only, will there be light at the end of the tunnel. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You just heard a talk by the Honorable Paul Hellyer on stopping a new free trade agreement between Canada and the European Union, and instead adopting a new social contract for Canada. This talk was conducted at the University of Winnipeg's Eckhart Gramaté Hall to an audience of over 100 people on the evening of October 20th, 2016, and roughly coincided with talks being conducted in Brussels intended to finalize and ratify the agreement known as CETA. Representatives of Canada and the European Union signed on to the agreement shortly after Mr. Hellyer presented this talk to Canadians. In February of 2017, the European Parliament voted to approve CETA, and in May, the Canadian bill to implement CETA was given royal assent. CETA was to have been provisionally implemented on July 1st, but has so far faced obstacles from EU countries. In spite of the European Parliament's approval, CETA must still be ratified by all 38 of the EU's national and regional parliaments. According to a statement from the European Commission, the President of the European Commission and the Prime Minister of Canada have set September 21, 2017 as the new date for the provisional implementation of the CETA. Paul Hellyer is currently a plaintiff in a constitutional legal challenge of CETA in the Canadian Federal Court. For more information on this strategy, please visit the website canadianbankreformers.ca and follow the links. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour's 2017 summer series, broadcast out of CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We air on participating radio stations across Canada and the United States and are podcast at globalresearch.ca. Audio this week was provided by videographer Paul Graham. You can find more of his work at the YouTube channel Paul S. Graham. Music was by Purple Planet Music. More selections are available at the website www.purple-planet.com. The Global Research News Hour will return next week with more special summer programming. My name is Michael Welch.